everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Coramdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're asking the question, is wokeness winning?
We're going to analyze a couple of different articles that were written over the past couple of months. Andrew Sullivan, a cultural commentator, well-known writer, I think used to write for The New Yorker, on Substack. He writes a newsletter called The Weekly Dish. He wrote one recently with the title, Why is Wokeness Winning? So he's asserting that wokeness is winning, and he's trying to give us reasons why. Then Coramdale intern Travis Barrett sent us along a dialogue between Sarah Hyder and Ayaan Hirsi Ali, two female writers, both feminists, both surprisingly ex-Muslims, and a lot of their work is advocacy for, they've sort of both flipped to atheism, and so a lot of what they do is they critique Islam, and especially sort of radical Islam, and they have been having a conversation with each other about how wokeness is similar to radical Islam, and so they... Travis sent us this little back and forth between the two of them where they're taking opposite sides on this question. Sarah Hyder, who writes First, believes that wokeness has won. The culture war is over. The woke have won. We are now part of the resistance if you're not into wokeness. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, on the other side, doesn't believe that wokeness has won. She thinks she actually believes that classical liberalism is going to have a resurgence and sort of wokeness is going to collapse in on itself because the classical liberals are not going to let sort of the woke ideology win the day. So the question is, what in the world are we talking about when we talk about wokeness? Chris, you got a good, nice summary definition for us, or should I just read Andrew Sullivan's?
You know, he's far more eloquent than I could ever be, so you should just read his.
He starts from here's the intro sentence. It's been a staggering achievement when you come to think of it. Critical theory was once an esoteric academic pursuit. Now it has become the core underlying philosophy of the majority of American cultural institutions, universities, media, corporations, liberal churches, NGOs, philanthropies, and of course, mainstream journalism. This summer felt like a psychic break from old school liberalism. A moment when a big part of the American elite just decided to junk the principles that have long defined American democratic life and embrace what Barry Weiss calls a mixture of postmodernism, postcolonialism, identity politics, neo-Marxism, critical race theory, intersectionality, and the therapeutic mentality. So now he's quoting there Barry Weiss, who was the editor of the New York Times editorial page until she was ousted this summer in a woke uprising. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the whole circumstances of that, but she was cast out. She is a liberal, Jewish, highly educated, highly intelligent person who was running the New York Times editorial page, but apparently she wasn't woke enough and so got thrown out. This is her. So this little phrase is her definition. I'm going to read it again. Quote, a mixture of postmodernism, postcolonialism, identity politics, neo-Marxism, critical race theory, intersectionality, and the therapeutic mentality. She says, throw all that in a blender and you end up with what we're calling wokeness. I think that's pretty good because she sort of has multiple layers to this. Some people would say wokeness is just critical race theory. Some people use neo-Marxism as sort of the defining principle of wokeness, but she's saying it's kind of all these things thrown in together, identity politics and intersectionality and therapeutic mentality. Throw all that in the blender, you get wokeness. Andrew Sullivan is just talking about it's everywhere. And this thing in the last year has sort of taken over the major mm-hmm. cultural institutions. He points out the New York Times' 1619 project, which of course was this whole project the New York Times set out on to say that the nation was not founded in 1776, but in 1619, and we should redate the American founding. Here's what Sullivan observes. CRT propaganda, like the New York Times' 1619 project, can be exposed as untrue and unethical, but the paper can both debunk it in its own pages and still hail it as a triumph, which is actually what the New York Times did. They had they ran a piece talking about how this was a bunch of crud, and then they're still sort of like putting it out there and holding it up as a viable proposal and a viable pursuit. So Sullivan goes on this article to give us all kinds of reasons why he thinks that wokeness is winning. He gives a, you know, you might agree or disagree with his argument here, and you can go read the article yourself, but here's a couple things he points out that I think are interesting. One reason for critical race theory's triumph is that it's super easy. He says one reason this is winning, so think about this. What he's saying is think about how kind of Trumpism, this sort of crude populist, right-leaning America first, you know, there's sort of a way that that is sort of monolithic and kind of easy, right? It has sort of some easy answers that, you know, if we just dealt with some, you know, took a particular stance on immigration and things like that, then that we would solve our problems. He's sort of suggesting critical race theory does the same thing from the left side of the scale. Here's what Sullivan goes on to say. Social inequalities are extremely complicated things. A huge variety of factors may be in play. Class, family structure, education, neighborhood, sex, biology, genetics, and culture are some of them. Untangling this empirically in order to figure out what might actually work to improve things is hard work. But when you can simply dismiss all these factors and cite structural racism as the only reason for any racial inequality, you're home free. Those who raise objections or complications or cite nuances can be dismissed by the same easy method. I think that's a really interesting insight, that it's just easy. There's an easiness to wokeness that doesn't require nuanced thought, that doesn't require us to ask hard questions about the multiple sources of some of the inequalities we have. But we can just say, oh, structural racism, or right, answers like that make it easy.
I don't disagree with this as a concept and idea. I do, though, have a question. I think this is a little bit of a caricature of critical race theory, though, isn't it? I mean, is wokeness and critical race theory essentially the same thing? Because
no,
and I think that's the question that I have, because critical race theory, if you were to read this article or this paragraph to those working in the field, academic field of critical race theory, I think they would say that's a complete caricature.
Yeah, and that's Sullivan's whole point, is that the problem here is that we're not talking about the people working in the academic field of critical race theory. We're talking about sort of the popularized version.
Yes, yes.
So he's saying critical race theory has provided the intellectual foundation that gives something like this sort of raw, crude wokeness a feeling that it has heft behind
it. Yeah, that's good. That's a really helpful clarification. Yeah.
This is interesting. Another thing that makes CRT so successful is ruthlessness. Those who hold a view of the world in which only power and the struggle for power matters have few qualms in exercising it. After all, under CRT, power is always on the side of the white, cis, hetero patriarchy.
Wow.
So payback is always fair play. Which I think, again, is an interesting point. He's saying, hey, this thing sort of leads to massive generalizations and just a simple power dynamic. And so as long as you're in power, we can just say, well, power is the problem. We don't have to, again, do the work to understand how this power came to be. Is it good power or bad power? Is there even such a thing as good power? We can just say, well, you're the oppressor. So he's suggesting that some of the simplicity of this woke ideology is a reason why it has sort of come to dominate some of our cultural institutions, and in a sort of surprising way, in a quick time frame. Here's how he concludes his article. The truth is that liberal democracy is hard, counterintuitive, complicated, and requires self-restraint, reason, and toleration at levels most humans are incapable of. That's why it is such a rare and fleeting exception in the world today, and all but non-existent for the vast majority of human history. Critical race theory is much more attuned to human nature. It gives you the simplest template for understanding the world. It assigns you virtue if you assent. It gives you instant power over others purely because of your and their identity. And it requires nothing more than tribal instinct to thrive. That's why it is here to stay, and why the fight for liberalism is going to be long and hard and require as much courage, steel, and rigor as we can muster. Again, this is his take, his perspective. Got any initial thoughts? No. Chris is just nodding. Chris is nodding in a very reflective way.
He is.
Dusty's looking across his microphone at me.
I think it would be helpful, Bob, if you, for me, and maybe for one other listener, if you could just in an elementary way say, here's what critical race theory is saying and here's what woke, going back to the blender definition.
Okay, so remember, let's do three things. When Andrusov and others use the language of liberalism, they're using it in the classical sense of classical philosophy, John Locke, and going all the way back to the foundings of America, that just says like, hey, human freedom is one of the highest virtues and values. So they're not using it in terms of like liberal versus conservative, left versus right. They're using it in the sense of this tradition politically that emphasizes human rights and the freedom of the individual and a government as the consent of a freely gathered group of people, right? So all the foundations of what we think of as democracy. That when they talk about liberalism, when Andrew Sullivan says wokeness is a threat to liberalism, that's the kind of liberalism he's talking about. Just what most of us take for granted as like basic democratic society. Critical race theory is, as we talked about on the podcast this summer with Kevin Estep, the view that racism inheres in things beyond just intention. So, of course, I can treat you with racist intent, but critical race theory sort of looks through the lens of how race can be embedded in structures of society. So there is it emphasizes structural components to racism. We talked about things like Jim Crow laws, where it doesn't, you know, the nice thing about a Jim Crow law, if you're a white Southern racist, is it just sort of does the work for you. You don't actually have to discriminate against anyone because you've created a system that discriminates. And so that's the kind of thing that critical race theory is pointing to and saying, can we talk about those things? What wokeness basically does, and again, to use the language that Barry Weiss used, it's this combination of critical race. So critical race theory gives it some intellectual foundation, but it also has intersectionality in there, which again is an academic theme that we've talked about a few times on the podcast. Postmodernism, postcolonialism, it's all this progressive ideology thrown in together that says, hey, anything that is traditional, anything that is conservative, anything that preserves sources of cultural power is all to be rebelled against. So when you think wokeness, just look back this summer to, for instance, some of what you saw with like defund the police, right? And what that movement is saying is, hey, the police is just a structure that needs to be torn apart. Doesn't matter. Let's not talk about specific police officers or departments or what they're doing or whether they're good or bad for society. It's just it's a powerful structure that has been abused in certain ways in certain cases, and therefore overthrow it, defund it, get rid of it.
Bob, might I? Do we want to jump to the second article, or is this too soon?
Let's do it.
There's what's the name of the Sarah? What's her last name?
Hyder?
Sarah. Yeah. She writes, wokeism is perhaps an anti-ideology, a will to power that can be identified not by what it values or the future it envisions, but by what it seeks to destroy and the power it demands.
You know, some parallels to this would be like wokeism is the push to be on the right side of history, right? It's like progressivism on steroids that says like, well, you know, revolution, like the trajectory toward a world after, you know, white male power or European Eurocentric culture or whatever, whatever we're heading toward, that's the only direction we should be going. And there is a sort of militance to it, which what's interesting about Sarah Hyder and Ayaan Hirsi Ali is they're saying it has similarities to Islam in the sense that it is a religious sort of ideology. It has a dogma to it, and there's a certain kind of militance that people can hold it with. I'm going to read another. You were reading a second letter there, Travis. I'm going to read it. Let me summarize this back and forth a little bit. Sarah Hyder believes that, as I said at the beginning, that wokeism has already won the culture war. And she says, at its core, this ideology is a delegitimization project. It targets the very foundations of humanist enlightenment values, which I think is interesting. It is, even as we look at critical race theory, we said that it had its roots in sort of the radical movement of the 1960s, that it very much is a radicalist sort of vision that seeks to deconstruct and tear down and she says to delegitimize. So it's a reaction against some of the very foundational things that drive Western culture. Enlightenment values and humanist ideology and all of these things. Now, what Sarah Hyder says is, wokeism has won because it has captured our cultural and sense-making institutions. Nearly all our educational, media, and nonprofit institutions are advancing in one direction. Meanwhile, the hearts and minds of the global elite are almost uniformly supportive of this new secular faith. One may object that the majority of Americans are not woke. I believe this is true. I also believe that it doesn't matter.
I love that line.
When so many of our fundamental institutions are in cult-like consensus, when the richest and most powerful among us routinely display public allegiance to one faith, the preferences of the average American are largely irrelevant. We must adjust our approach accordingly. To put it rather dramatically, we are not meeting the barbarians at the gate. We are rebelling against the empire. So she says, if you don't agree with wokeism, it's not that you're trying to hold it off from taking power. It's that you're rebelling against the empire. This is the new empire. This ideology has won. Now, Ayaan Hirsi Ali disagrees. She says, Sarah, I love you. I agree with some of your concerns, but I don't think wokeism has won. Here's why. She says, as long as there are true liberals out there, I do not think the woke are anywhere near any kind of victory. The key thing to remember is the resilience of the philosophy of liberalism, the sheer strength of the institutions that evolved based on those principles, and the strength of the ideas and ideals of universal human rights, individual freedom, the sanctity of law, the rule of law and property rights, the democratic process, free inquiry, science, and free markets. Islam has mounted a partly successful resistance to all these ideas for centuries at the price of impoverishing Muslim-majority societies around the world. But wokeism is a far less compelling ideology. It seems to me that the more the woke turn their fire against true liberals, the more they reveal the fundamental intellectual bankruptcy of their cult, and the more they encourage other true liberals to cease the appeasement of wokeism that has characterized the past decade or so. She might have a point here that true liberals will eventually repudiate wokeism and the way that it has come to dominate, like even what happened at the New York Times just this year. Here's a funny quote that she uses in this letter. This is a letter back and forth. So they're basically writing letters to each other and posting them on the internet. So it's kind of a dialogue between these two thinkers that we all get to listen in on. Here's a quotation from a professor named Sunny Singh, who teaches a creative writing course at London Metropolitan University. And Ayaan Hirsi Ali is using this as an example of, if people just get enough of this, they're going to realize this is just stupid and dumb. We need to just be done with this ideology. So here's the quote from this professor. I get regular invites to debate on various platforms. I always say no, because debate is an imperialist, capitalist, white supremacist, cis, heteropatriarchal technique that transforms a potential exchange of knowledge into a tool of exclusion and oppression.
Wow.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali is just saying, if that gets said enough times, people are just going to be like, yeah, that's a bunch of crud. Like, whatever. Debate is not a white supremacist, cis, hetero, patriarchal technique. It's called how people learn. So she's suggesting that liberalism, true classical liberalism, is going to rise up and overthrow that. That wokeness just doesn't have the power to sustain itself. I'm not so sure, but I think it's an interesting debate. Having sat there for 15 minutes now to listen to me summarize these articles, friends,
good job.
What do you have to?
Good job.
What do you have to say here? What do you? Who do you think has the better case here? Is wokeness the new empire, or is it just a sort of momentary ideology that's eventually going to sort of be cast out by classical liberal ideals?
Several thoughts. First one, do you remember how, like, I don't know, we can even go back to the first Obama. When was Obama first?
2008.
2008. He ran on this, what would be considered a very conservative view of sexuality. Like, he wasn't pro same-sex marriage. And remember how, I don't remember exactly what year it was, but it felt like even over the summer, there was just this instantaneous turn of, like, all of a sudden, the commonly sort of accepted view is homosexual marriage should be legal, that, and then that just sort of, like, opened the floodgates. And then there was another year where it was just like all of a sudden, okay, this whole trans thing, that's just everybody sort of just believed this. It just, there was this sort of magical moment where what was at one time agreed upon just all of a sudden was deemed unacceptable. And it just seemed like it happened overnight. Obviously, the foundations for that have been laid for a long time. This feels very similar in some ways. Like all of a sudden, the assumptions of wokeness were just swallowed whole scale by the culture. Like, I know that the seedbed for this has been over time, and there have been a number of situations that really fan the flame. I mean, real instances of injustice that fan the flame. But just how quickly the woke sort of assumptions and ideology and presuppositions have been accepted by the cultural elite is fascinating to me. And so in some ways, I think this could be kind of a similar thing where there's this flashpoint right now where it's really intense and it's starting to deconstruct some things and it's working its way into our systems. But then at some point, the emotion will settle down, and then I think the presuppositions of wokeness are just going to be kind of like commonly accepted, even if it's not at an academic level or, you know, talk about the average person and you ask them, hey, what do you think about homosexuality or homosexual marriage or transgenderism? And they're probably not going to have like a super strong opinion on it, but they're probably going to repeat sort of the culturally accepted view. I think that's kind of how wokeism is going to eventually play itself out in our culture, where I don't know to the extent that it's going to transform, but I think it's going to make its way into just, hey, this is sort of how we see things. And for the average person, it doesn't necessarily really affect my life, but you know, that I suppose that's right. I suppose that's true. That's kind of where I think this is going to head. I think part of it, it may be, you know, transform things more whole scale, but that's kind of the parallel that I'm drawing right now.
So you would say it's, if I'm understanding you correctly, it's here to stay, but it's going to settle down a little bit.
Yes.
I wonder, going back in your timeline, if the rise of wokeness is a rough analog to the rise of Trump. Because I'm thinking, we did our first intersectionality podcast in 2017. Mm-hmm. And it was an Andrew Sullivan article, by the way, that teed up that podcast. He was the first one to say, hey, did you all see this coming? Because this is happening on campuses all of a sudden. And now that whole intersectionality thing is not on college campuses. It's front and center in every cultural conversation that's going on. So I wonder if you had this, to your point, Chris, this latent sort of some latent ideology that when the left saw the rise of Trump in 2016 and realized, oh, there's this sort of virulent strain of very nationalistic, highly conservative, almost, you know, messianic style, right-leaning political movement, if that opened up the door for, if in other words, the left had to go sort of in a direction that would give it the same kind of, I don't want to call it militance, but the same kind of, because if you think about classic liberalism is Bill Clinton, right? I mean, it's like, hey, y'all, boxers, not briefs, you know, it's just like, it's just a good old guy from Arkansas who, you know, doesn't have super conservative views, but at the end of the day, just wants to be a good guy and help the country, right? And that's not what sort of the woke agenda is. The woke agenda is very much more polarizing. It's very much, if you don't agree with these things, you are a racist, or you are a sexist, or you are backward, or you are an outsider, or you are unwelcome in the conversation, which is what happened to Barry Weiss at the New York Times, right? It's like this you can't be the editorial page editor anymore because you're not left enough. You're not embracing enough of the ideology that we want you to embrace.
Yeah, and let's be honest too, wokeism has fuel because of the history of this country.
Correct.
Because there is so much racial tensions and racial dynamics that have been the entire history of our country. Because with the rise of Trump, what was that viewed as? Also sort of the rise of the white working class that felt they had been left behind under Obama, now asserting themselves. And so when one, it's not just social class, but racial demographic is starting to, you know, assert itself with a ton of fervor, that's going to provoke the fires of whatever racial tension have been existing in our country So I think you're right, Bob. And there is a sense where this is a reactionary, or it was given a certain level of just injection because it was on college campuses, but it was moved out into the mainstream, into the world, off the campus because of what had happened politically. But it's also interesting, though, because it started on campus, and college campuses are supposed to be the place where academic freedom and an exchange of ideas is supposed to thrive. And yet here you see the wokeness and intersectionality going after and trying to gut these institutions that are supposed to be like the standard bearer for intellectual freedom. And so even this, to see the way that universities have responded, some of them in a ton of fear, some of them have actually capitulated to some of the demands, but I think there's also a sense where they're trying to reassert some of that academic freedom in some ways. So it may be what happens on the college and university campuses over the next 5-10 years is going to be reflective of what happens, whether or not liberalism, classical liberalism, will actually survive, which would be a really interesting sort of irony and flip if where people have said universities are kind of where liberalism was dying, could they be the places where it's reestablished in order to sort of reestablish it back into the mainstream culture?
Mm. I'm a pessimist here, so I think probably not.
I agree with you. I don't think so.
Just for the sake of conversation.
Yeah, I think, I mean, honestly, I'm not saying like we're going to devolve into civil war. I think we're just going to become a much more fragmented country. You're going to have these hotbeds of wokeism on the coasts, and then you're going to try to, you know, kind of more in the Midwest and more conservative enclaves, you're going to try to guard against it. I mean, I'm just thinking of our context, Bellevue. Like, we're far more conservative culturally than even Omaha in some ways. Like, you go into the average place, average business in Omaha, and you're not going to find much example of wokeism. I mean, it might
so
be.
So you say.
Well, maybe we're delayed by 20 years, but I think that you're going to have a much easier time sort of buttressing against it in a place like Bellevue, places, you know.
I want to invite all you listeners who've had to go to a mandatory diversity training in the last 12 months to email Chris Hillman.
Yes, if you live in Sarpy County, I'll extend it, Sarpy County, if you have experienced wokeism, full frontal wokeism in Sarpy County, let me know, because I would like to know to what degree, because no one has like complained to me yet. A little bit in the military, but that's because it's broader. But other than that,
yeah, I've had lots of conversations with people who in their workplace have had to endure various kinds of diversity training and that are very much in line with sort of the woke agenda. I think it's
like they had to read White Fragility.
Or go to like gender identity workshops where it's like, hey, here's all the pronouns that now exist besides he and she, right? Yeah. Those kinds of things. So I do think there's, it's interesting to me to ask, it seems like these authors are saying, hey, the firewall against wokeness would be classical liberalism reasserting itself. I think that's interesting. I'm not convinced that's a reality. I wonder if the firewall against wokeness could be the gospel or the kingdom of God. And natural law, if I can say that as a Protestant. Because I think what's interesting about wokeness that they point out is it common sense actually repudiates wokeness.
Yeah, it should.
Anyone with common sense can say, hey, it's not as simple as if you disagree with rioting and looting, you're a racist. Like, it's not as simple as all in or all out. There's a lot of nuanced middle here of conversations we should be having that we're not having. I think the average person knows that. And I think that's why you see, like, it's interesting what happened with Trump this past election, right, where he picks up a bunch of Hispanic vote in Florida. That people are like, well, how come all these Hispanic I saw people on Twitter saying these Cubans are not real Hispanics. They're actually white culturally. They're culturally white. And it's just ridiculous, right? You're just like, no, these are actually people who have come from a dictatorship. And there might be things that Trump is saying that actually appeal to them. Could we actually think about that for 5 minutes instead of just saying, well, if they're a minority and they voted for Trump, it's because they're betraying their heritage and they're obviously white supremacists just with Cuban heritage.
Yeah. Maybe they're voting for Trump because what America feels like right now is where they came from.
Right. Could that possibly be the case? Yeah. So
go ahead.
No, that's.
Yeah, I was going to say the reason I agree with you about liberalism as becoming this buttress against it is because where is classical liberalism even being taught or established? Like, where does it exist as a stronghold with enough energy and resource to mount a counterattack? It seemed like it's been, for the most part, eroded from our culture-shaping institutions.
And I would suggest, in contrast to Ayaan Hirsi Ali, I think wokeism is the last vestige of classical liberalism. I think it's the Enlightenment eating itself.
Yeah. This is Patrick Deneen.
Yeah, it's Pat Deneen's whole argument, right? Yeah. It's like, this is when you only emphasize individual freedom, where does that lead you?
Yep.
It leads you to a place where now the only thing that matters is whatever I say works for me. And that's what wokeism is. It's identity politics on steroids, right? And identity politics is just fragmenting us into more and more subgroups of subgroups that somehow share some common identity that allows us to say that we're oppressed or that we're marginalized in some way. That's working against some sort of cultural consensus that says, here's who we are as a people, and here's the values that have sort of shaped us, and here's the assumptions that we share and hold societally.
So what we're telling you, listener, is buckle up, settle in, and get used to it.
Well, I do think it's interesting. I've been having conversations with leaders in Acts 29 over the past few weeks, and we've been talking about, hey, what does it mean for us to reengage missionality as a church planting movement and really plant, you know, missional churches that really are reaching the culture? And the case I'm trying to make for them is to say, hey, I don't know that mission is ever going to look like it did in 2008 or 9, because the cultural shift has been dramatic since then. So it's there's no dialing back the clock to, like, let's just do what we did that worked 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago. The church is going to have to figure out, what does it mean to live on mission in a world where wokeness has become sort of the successor ideology, the implicit worldview of a lot of people, whether they can express it well or not.
Would you say similar to when the big shift of postmodernism kind of made itself, like, sort of asserted itself in a significant way, and the church had to think about what it meant to be on mission in a more fully postmodern world? Because in some ways, this is a shift away from, I mean, it certainly carries aspects of postmodernism, will to power and certain other things. But in some ways, this is a post-postmodern phenomenon as well. And so that shift too of, what does it look like to do ministry not in a postmodern world, but in a woke world, where some of the rules have changed?
I was big into postmodern contextualization back in the early 2000s. And in hindsight, I don't think there is such a thing as postmodernism. I think postmodernism was a movement in literary criticism, but I think culturally it was just modernism. It was just another version of modernism. Because for all of postmodernism's, all the sort of supposed realities of postmodernism, doesn't believe in truth anymore and everything's relative, it was clear in 5 minutes that actually no one can hold a view that everything is relative, right? Yeah. So postmodernism was just like, I think it was just it was a movement in this direction toward this identity politics kind of worldview that just says, hey, just assert what you think is true. And if you say it loudly enough, that makes other people have to listen to you. So for what it's worth, yes and no is kind of the question, what I'm answering to your question, Chris. Yes, it's like postmodernism, except for I don't know that postmodernism was even a thing.
I remember reading that postmodern evangelical book by Weber.
Yeah.
In 2003.
Yeah.
Probably. And
there was like 5 years of really interesting writing on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Erwin McManus.
Yeah. And it did help the church break out of some cultural trappings that I think were more 1950s and 1960s contextualization. So that, for that reason, it was good. But I think that whole movement oversold the assumptions of postmodernism as being essential. You know, it's just like, well, maybe. But I'm not convinced I had any neighbors who were real postmoderns. I think I had neighbors who were consumeristic and relativistic people, which I would just say is late modernism. But we're getting too philosophically askew. So let's land this plane, Mike Kresnik.
Well, I just wanted to bring something up, and maybe this will be more along the lines of where we want to land it, or maybe even enter into another conversation about it. But Sullivan here in his article talks about how there's a religious component to this idea of wokeness. He says a generation of nuns can feel bereft of transcendence and meaning and become woke, like being born again. It fills that natural or that spiritual hole. In a lonely age, feeling as if you are on the right side of history, banishing doubt, joining with countless of your fellow converts in marches and seminars can abate the isolation and emptiness of it all. Many moderns want the experience of religion without God. I was compelled by that because the gospel gives us purpose. The kingdom of God gives individuals purpose and belonging in the people of God. And people are hungry for that. So they're going to go wherever they can find that. But if they want it without God, they're going to go to other places. And I think this is where the church can actually have hope, because the church will prevail through whatever is coming in the next 50 years. The question is are we willing to be ready to welcome these people in when
the wokeness runs out?
When the wokeness runs out and they're tired and they're fatigued and they're hurt and wounded.
But they still want to belong somewhere.
But they still want to belong. And right. How can we speak into that now?
Yeah, and what Sullivan is pointing out here is that everybody worships. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Worship is at the core of human anthropology. And so if I don't worship God, as Romans 1 tells me, I will worship something else. I will turn some created thing into the creator.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We love to hear from you, the listeners, so send us your thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics to podcast@cdomaha.com, and we'll see you again next Wednesday for another Wednesday Conversation.